The Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives is one of Canada's best think tanks and best research organizations. Hugh McKenzie is the senior analyst, and he has recently published a report called Canada's Best Paid CEOs, Recession Proof. We had the great luck of talking to Hugh McKenzie. He was in quite demand, and finding out a little bit more about what goes on with CEO pay packages, why they are recession-proof, how they continue to grow income while the numbers of poverty increase.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
We're speaking to Hugh McKenzie, the senior researcher for Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. I'm sure you've been very busy talking with many of the press. Has it been going well?
Yeah, there is a lot of interest in this story this year. I'm not really quite sure why. I think that it may have something to do with the fact that we are still only at the beginning and very beginning of getting out of the recession. And so when people hear that in the year that was by any standard of comparison in the pit of the recession, the average income of the top 100 CEOs in Canada was more than $6.5 million, I think, you know, people pay attention to that.
Yeah, there's such a gross disparity. I was talking to Armine a couple of weeks ago, and we were discussing her report. What I would like to do is, of course, find an answer for how to get out of these loopholes and explain some of the loopholes. But before we start, maybe we should explain to the listener how these CEOs are paid.
Well, CEOs are paid in a variety of different forms. I think that part of it is designed to make it confusing. Your typical CEO will get a base salary, which is already in the stratosphere compared with what most normal people would think is reasonable. I mean, for example, the base salary for the CEO of one of the banks would be over $1 million.
Wow.
Then on top of that, then you add to that the annual bonus.
Oh, right.
And the annual bonus is based in some way on some measure of the executive's individual performance. And typically the annual bonus will be the same as the salary. So in other words, you get your salary. Again, it's kind of hard for the average person to appreciate the way this works, but it's like you get $1 million a year just for showing up.
Right.
And then you get $1 million a year on top of that for doing your job.
For the cost of living increase.
Well, no, just for doing your job. I mean, there's $1 million a year breathing allowance, and then if you actually do something, you get another million.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then typically there's two or three other forms in which CEOs get paid. One is that corporations will often give executives stock in the company.
Right.
As a form of a bonus. It's not a cash bonus. They're given shares in the company, and there's usually some limits on when they can sell them. And then another popular form of compensation for executives is what's known as a stock option. And let me explain briefly what a stock option is. A stock option is the right to buy a share in the company at some predetermined price. So let's say that predetermined price is $10 a share. And so I'm a chief executive. I might be granted the right to buy 100,000 shares in the company at $10 a share.
No matter what it's really selling at.
Right. And there's usually some date in the future before I can exercise it, before I can actually use the option. So let's say I have to wait for 3 years. So in 3 years' time, I'll look at the share price, and if the, let's say the share price has gone up to $20, which is not an unreasonable example. So I've got the right to buy the shares at 10, and they're selling at 20. So what I do is I buy, I exercise my right to buy the shares at 10, and I immediately sell them for 20.
Get your profit.
And I take my $1 million profit immediately. So that's the way stock options work. And I'll come back to those in a second because there's a story that goes with those. And then on top of that, if that wasn't enough, some, not all, but some chief executives also have extremely generous pension plans. So we'll come back to stock options because there's a story that goes with that that I think is interesting. And then on top of that, the typical, not all chief executives, but many chief executives will have a very, very generous pension plan. Like, don't think about your pension plan when you're thinking about what CEOs get. We're talking about pension plans that, you know, will deliver a monthly pension of $300,000 or $400,000. We're talking pension plans on double steroids here. And then there's kind of a basket category of other payments. A lot of them having to do with either with perks of the job, like, you know, a company car or health club memberships, that sort of stuff. Again, this is something that that your listeners will have a little trouble identifying with. Most executive officers' contracts with their corporate employers pay them severance when they quit.
Right.
So, you know, for example, the chief executive officer of Canadian National got a severance payment of $2 million when he quit.
How long was he working before he actually quit?
Oh, I think he worked for the company for about 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's another category. And basically, the way these things break down, typically, the salary and annual bonus will account for about a third of the executive's pay. Stock options will account for about a third, and grants of shares will account for about a third. You're looking at the average guy, and incidentally, they're all men. All 100 on the list this year are men. If you look at the average one who took in about $6.5 million, a little over $2 million of that would have been salary and bonus. A similar amount would have been stock options, and a similar amount would have been grants of shares. So that's essentially the way it breaks down.
This seems to be outside of the fact that there is such a wider disparity than the last time I spoke about this with either you or someone from the center. The difference is much higher. There are more options, it seems, than I've heard about before.
Well, yes. Stock options have become a very popular way to pay chief executive officers. There's a very simple and straightforward reason why. Under Canadian tax law, income that you receive from the exercise of a stock option is taxed as if it's a capital gain. And so that means that it's taxed at half the rate that the tax that the income most of your listeners would receive. And so in effect, Canadians generally, through their taxes, are subsidizing the options income of these executives.
Yeah, that's
maddening. And it's a considerable benefit for a CEO, for the average CEO. I estimated that the value of the tax subsidy is worth about $430,000. You know, you could suggest that move into the living room of these guys, because you're essentially paying for about a third of the cost of their house.
How long is that kind of?
Well, the special tax treatment for stock options has been going on since the mid-1980s. That was one of the gifts that Mulroney's finance minister, Michael Wilson, gave to the financial services industry.
Right, and it's never been pulled back by any other government following.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's I've been talking about this issue for several years now, and I have never heard from anybody even the most fervent apologist for the way CEOs are paid, I have never heard a coherent explanation for or coherent justification for treating these things as if they're capital gains.
Yeah.
The whole point, I don't agree with it, but the justification that's given for giving special treatment to capital gains is really twofold. One is that you need to compensate people for the effect of inflation on the value of their assets, because economically you probably don't want to be taxing people on the basis of increases in value of assets that just come from ordinary inflation. And the lower tax rate is justified on the basis that that compensates for the effect of inflation on the value of the assets. And the other justification that's advanced is that when you hold an asset that's subject to capital gains tax, you're taking a risk, and you ought to have a lower tax rate on the benefits that you receive to compensate for the fact that you've got money at risk. Well, for a CEO and his stock options, neither of those justifications holds up.
No.
The ownership period for the shares that are involved here is literally measured in nanoseconds, because these executives buy these shares, they exercise their right to buy these shares, and they sell them immediately.
So they're flipping them.
So they're just flipping them. Yeah, exactly. These get flipped, and they literally hold them for nanoseconds. So there's no justification based on inflation for providing special tax treatment. And it's in the nature of a stock option that you don't have any money at risk. Because in the example that we used at the beginning of the conversation, if I get the right to buy a share at $10 and the value of the share drops to $5, I just don't buy it.
That's right.
I have the option of not buying it. And that's what you do, right? So that if your stock options aren't going to pay, then you don't exercise them. So there's no money at risk. You've got no money at risk at all. So that justification also just doesn't hold water. Because a dollar paid to me as a stock option is literally worth about 25% more than a dollar paid to me as a bonus.
Can you explain that?
Well, because if I get a dollar in a stock option, let's use a simple example. Let's assume that my marginal tax rate is 50%. So every additional dollar that I make in income, I pay 50 cents in tax. So if I get this as an ordinary bonus, if I get my dollar as an ordinary bonus, then that dollar nets me 50 cents, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I get it in the form of a stock option, half of that dollar is tax-free, and the other half of it I pay 50% on. So I end up with the after tax, my dollar's worth of stock options is worth 75 cents. So the stock option after tax is worth three times what a dollar paid in a bonus is worth.
Isn't that illegal?
It's absolutely legal. Is it ridiculous? Of course it is.
Yes. So I'll continue on. I mean, we need to find out all the ways that these CEOs get this kind of large salary.
Right. I think one of the of all of the things that that go into the CEO issue, I think the one that is the most outrageous is that stock option income is given this special preferential tax treatment. I think that is ridiculous. And what's interesting is that for a completely different set of reasons, a lot of normally fairly conservative people in the business academic community are writing things and saying things that are really quite hostile to the use of stock options as a way of paying people. The economic/business reason for not liking stock options is that by paying people in the form of stock options, you're encouraging executives to make decisions not based on the fundamental economic health of the company, but based on what the stock market thinks the shares will be worth. And that, in these people's view, which I agree with, that tends to mean that shareholders, for example, that you have a much shorter term orientation than actually makes economic sense for the company. It also means that you get these perverse things where the classic example of it is the guy who became known as Chainsaw Dunlop, who took a series of jobs as CEOs of major American manufacturing companies and made himself enormous bonuses through stock options by laying off tens of thousands of people and ultimately basically destroyed those companies. But in the process, in the short term, he cashed in massively because the price of the shares went up when he laid all the people off.
Right. So this, he did this on purpose, and that is, I don't know how, what error of the stock market that is that would say
well,
that's
is,
illegal.
He was doing his thing in the 80s, but there are people that are, I mean, there are people that are doing that today. There are people that are today making decisions about the fundamental structure of companies based on what they think is going to happen to the price of the shares in the next 6 months.
No interest in the company, just how to manipulate it.
Exactly. And it's so bad that when you see a leader of a major corporation that isn't doing that, that's news. So to give you an example, I picked up in my copy of the Sunday New York Times a few weeks ago, there was a big favorable article about Jeffrey Immelt, who's the chief executive officer of General Electric. And this very laudatory article was talking about how he's declared that he really doesn't care what happens to the price of the shares in the next 6 months or the next year. What he's interested is in making sure that General Electric is a viable manufacturing business, you know, 20 years from now. And he's made a number of decisions that reflect that. And what struck me in reading that was that it was odd that that was news.
Yeah.
It was odd. It was sort of, you know, write a newspaper headline, a corporate executive is actually making decisions in the long-term interest of his company.
Well, yeah. I'm surprised other shareholders haven't spoken up about this.
Well, it's interesting, actually. The stock market really functions like a kind of gambling enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
When you buy a share in a company, you basically buy shares of a company for two reasons. One is because you think the company is going to pay you a dividend and you're going to get a decent income out of it. And the other is that you think that the value of the stock is going to go up and you'll be able to sell it for a profit. And the stock market today is overwhelmingly oriented towards capital gains. And so they're completely focused on what's happening to the price of the shares of the company, to the point that a lot of investment managers can't even tell you what dividend income they're getting because they just don't care.
So there's obviously no concern about the company, whether it's environmentally friendly or some of the workers are...
It's very tough to find the long-term focus. The environmental issues, in a rational world, even if you were only worried about what was going to happen in the next 6 months, environmental issues ought to worry people. Because although even if you're not buying the company to hold the stock for a long time, you've got no guarantee that there won't be an environmental disaster next week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure there were lots of people that bought BP stock last February thinking, you know, I think that that when the summer comes and the economy starts to recover, the price of crude oil is going to go up and BP stock is going to go up and I'm going to make a bundle. So they bought that stock thinking that they were going to make a big capital gain out of in the process. And then out of the blue, there's a financial disaster created by an environmental problem. So, you know, a reasonable person, even investing for the short term, should be worried about these things.
especially in today's world. So how do we, well, you're exposing them or slowly exposing them by doing these kinds of reports and interviews. How do we undo some of these illegal little tweaks that corporations have been doing?
Well, I mean, I think that to use the lingo that people use in the investment business all the time, politically, I think the low-hanging fruit here is the tax treatment of stock options. There is no justification for providing this kind of bonus to people who receive incomes in the form of stock options. Absolutely no justification at all. And that would do two things. One is that it would generate some revenue. Actually, it would do a number of things. It would generate some revenue. It would deliver the message. It would begin to deliver the message that, as a society, we don't like these outrageous open-ended salary provisions. And the third is that it would make paying people in the form of stock options much less attractive financially for companies and chief executive officers. So that's an easy piece of low-hanging fruit. Beyond that, there's been a fair amount of discussion, particularly more in the United States than here, which is interesting because usually Americans seem to be less worried about these things than we are. But there's been a fair amount of discussion in the United States about what to do as a public policy about CEO salaries and the fact that they just seem to be escalating out of control. And the debate really revolves around whether there should be public regulation of what CEOs are paid, or whether we should just let corporations pay CEOs whatever they want and then tax it away. And I'm actually in the tax it away camp. I think that once we've gotten rid of the tax subsidy for income from stock options, we should move on to put some slope back into the income tax system so that we're levying taxes at a much higher rate on these exorbitant incomes. And again, that would do two things. One is it would generate some revenue for the Treasury and enable us to afford better public services. But the other is that it would deliver a clear message about what we as a society feel about these kind of outrageous pay levels.
A moral.
Yeah, it would stake out some moral ground.
Do you think that will happen with this government?
No. In a word, no.
No.
I don't. And I don't expect it to happen quickly. But, I mean, these things take a long time to develop. And, you know, even in the United States, where this debate is much further advanced than it is in Canada, you know, it's like we take one step forward and then we take a step backwards. 6 months ago, I would have said that there was really a fair amount of interest publicly in public policy terms in doing something to curb these extraordinarily high incomes. But based on the results of the congressional elections and the strength of the so-called Tea Party movement, and the fact that even the democratically controlled Congress, even the democratically controlled lame duck Congress, voted to extend the Bush millionaire tax cut. You know, it's not exactly smooth sailing on these issues in the United States either.
Well, that's obviously because they have something to gain themselves.
Well, and that's an interesting point, and it's one of the points that I've made in a couple of the interviews I've done on this report, that one of the difficulties that we face in taking any public policy action on these extraordinarily high pay packages is that the very people that we're trying to target with these public policy measures are the very people who have the most disposable income, which they can use to lobby against them.
You are listening to The Other Side of the News, and Hugh McKenzie from the Canadian Center of Policy Alternatives talking about the 100 richest CEOs in Canada.
Right, so it's a pretty difficult political environment to be in.
You're saying it's too difficult to do it on a provincial level. in Canada.
It couldn't be done on a provincial level. It
has to be done federally.
It has to be done nationally. Hmm. And you know, I mean, the problem is that for a number of reasons, some of which have to do with more liberalized international trade and investment agreements, you know, these guys are very mobile. And particularly between Canada and the United States, but also more broadly. One of the things that's very interesting to me in the executive compensation world is that it turns out that the worst excesses in executive compensation are happening in the so-called English-speaking world.
How do you mean?
So Canada, the United States, the UK, Australia. And that's because that's largely driven by the out-of-control movement of salaries in the United States. But it speaks to the impact of executive mobility on one's ability to manage and control these things.
The wording of the policies or the wording of the...
No, what I'm thinking about is that if you're looking to hire a CEO for, say, a big Canadian manufacturing company,
right,
and, you know, you identify somebody that you want to hire, if you're not paying an amount that's competitive with what somebody could make in Australia or the United States or Britain, at some point you're going to get to the point where you can't hire the people that you want because you're going to be outbid by other people. And that's what I mean by that. For sure, it doesn't make sense to try to do this at the provincial level because it's just too easy for people to avoid paying it.
So now another question that comes to mind here, if you're looking at the salary of a CEO, if you're looking to hire somebody to help your company, and you have explained a lot of CEOs come in for 1 quarter, 6 months, whatever, do their job, they're getting paid all these millions anyway. If that used to be, and I don't know if it is still, the money was a layer or a level of indication of how well that CEO could deliver, how well they could do the job.
Right.
And now we don't have that measure.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, if you look at what CEOs are paid, I haven't done the study myself, but others have done studies looking at the relationship between CEO pay and profitability or sales or, you know, any other measure of corporate performance, and you find that there really isn't any relationship.
Well, it's a very scary scenario. They're living in some, I would like to say, the Alice land, not in reality. There is an environmental factor as a blowback to what they are doing, how they're setting up this.
Right.
And we are at a very sensitive point in our environmental future.
Right.
Because of the amount of money that's paid, the amount of poverty, the amount of taxation from the middle class. I see poverty issues all the time. That's all I deal with. And mm-hmm. I mean, I just talked to some people that were from the U.S. Steel strike that are in now dire poverty. They are now on OW, which is the worst of the worst, because
right.
EI runs out and they don't have any money.
Right.
Can you give me a company scenario? Could you give me a company scenario like U.S. Steel?
Actually, Stelco is a really good example of some things. Anyway, when Stelco went into creditor protection, it was led into creditor protection by a chief executive officer that didn't have anything at risk. He'd already locked up his pay, his severance benefits, his pension had already been locked up, And he actually stood to gain through the process that he was forcing the company through. And, you know, in a world in which executive pay is dominated by stock options, you end up with two effects, neither of which is a very good thing. One is that you end up with large companies being led by people who really could give a damn what the state of the company was going to be 5 years from now.
Right. It could
they
be
could
making
care
money.
Less.
Yeah.
And the other is, and this is something that people haven't really focused on, is that you create a situation in which the leaders of a company actually benefit significantly from volatility in the value of the company on the stock market. The reason why I say that is because, to come back to the little example that we started the conversation with, if I have an option to buy the company, to buy shares in the company at $10, all I really care about is getting that price up to $20 at the point where I can sell, right? And 5 minutes after I sell, I don't care what happens. In fact, 5 minutes after I sell, I would really like the stock to tank so that the next options I get will be at a low price. Because the way stock options are granted, typically what will happen is if I'm granted a stock option as of December 1st, say, my right to buy the stock will be based on the price at which I can buy the stock is based on what the stock is trading for on December 1st. So I'm actually, as the chief executive officer of this company, I'm actually in a position where the more volatile the price of the stock is, the better opportunities I've got to make a lot of money. The worst thing that could happen to me is if the stock just gradually increases in value over time.
Yeah, that's
because
so cool.
That doesn't generate any big windfalls for me.
Right. So different business practices, absolutely.
That's what some of these business academics are starting to write about. I mean, one of the people that I quote in the paper extensively is Roger Martin, who's the dean of the business school at the University of Toronto, and he basically characterizes pay based on stock and stock options as a form of gambling.
It is.
A form of gambling that is completely divorced from what's really going on in the company.
And from reality,
exactly.
The environment that we live in, the fallout that's happening with the problems we're having with oil, it's already peaked. Absolutely no moral fiber is what I want to say, to leave behind a trail of destruction, bad air, bad water, etc.
Well, it's a system that gives no incentive to anybody to worry about any of that stuff.
Yeah, so they have no moral compass.
Yeah, right.
That's exactly what they did with Stelco, and that's why they're picketing down there now. It's U.S. Steel,
mm-hmm.
But what you're seeing is looks like the same thing is being applied. U.S. Steel gave a bunch of agreements with the province when it took over that Stelco plant, and they talked about the pensions. They talked about the geared to income pensions, having them indexed.
Yeah.
Nothing that any of these CEOs agree to mean anything, even if they've got paper and they've signed it, as we're watching right now when they've kicked out 900, the last remaining plant workers.
Yeah.
As they try to fight to get rid of the pensions from the other plant workers that put 35 years of their life into Stelco.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So yeah, we don't have any credibility. There's no control. We're kind of floating around in I don't know. I don't know what they're teaching in schools now for the new next level of CEOs. I don't know if they're teaching the Tom...
They're teaching them how to make money.
Not how to run
themselves.
Not how to run a plant, not how to run a healthy corporation. Can't that direction be stopped? Can't the education part of this and the universities be...
Well, I think again, you know, these things have a tendency to take a long time. But one of the things that I have been struck by is the sort of, if I can put it this way, there's a kind of growing cast of unusual suspects that are raising concerns about these practices, and that to the extent that I have any cause for optimism, that's where it lies. That there are people that you wouldn't expect ordinarily to be worried at all about these kinds of issues, who are speaking out publicly about them.
Can you say names? Can you say names?
Well, I talked to you about Roger Martin from the business school at the University of Toronto. Not exactly the kind of person that you would expect to be a leading critic of a business pay practice. There's a professor at McGill University who's an internationally known accounting theorist, and he wrote a really scathing critique of the way executives are paid that was published in the Wall Street Journal a year and a half ago.
Okay.
So there are some leading figures that are out there on the public record as saying this just doesn't make any sense.
But they're still teaching him.
Well, it's not so much what they're teaching as it is the way to put it bluntly. I mean the CEOs have it pretty good at the moment. It's a kind of incestuous little self-referential club.
Mm-hmm.
That sets their pay, and you've got you sit on my board, I sit on your board, and
exactly.
We both sit on each other's compensation committees, and we make sure that our common interests are taken care of by making sure that your pay isn't making any statements about the reasonableness of these pay systems that might come back to haunt me, you know?
Okay.
It's all pretty self-referential.
Right. I'm just reading this quote by Roger about the football quarterback and how he says the price to pay a football quarterback is not based on whether his team beats the betting points or the spread or his ability to be a good quarterback. I can't seem to see this working and getting away with. Well, for over 30 years, we've seen massive layoffs, massive job losses, massive plants being closed down. Everyone's looking around, wondering, where did the money go? Where did the job go? How can we have an economy? How can we be in debt when we've got this kind of pay package going on at the same time?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have an easy answer to it.
Is there anything else you want to say to...
No, not really. I think we sort of covered the waterfront here.
Okay. What would you like people to do? Can you suggest any places people go and get information for themselves?
Well, there's lots of good stuff on these issues on the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives
right.
website. One of the things that I would encourage people to do is to draw the linkages. Between amounts that CEOs are paid and this phenomenon of growing income inequality that we've seen across Canada.
Yes, this is part of your growing gap.
Yeah, that's right. This is the growing gap, and the reason why it's important to keep all of this in mind is that the CEO thing is in fact. The most visible of it's the most visible manifestation of the driving force behind the growing inequality that my colleague Armin Yalnizian identified in the report that the CCPA released in November, and just to locate it there, that report found that fully one third. Of the income growth in Canada that took place between 1997 and 2007 accrued to the highest paid 1% of Canadians.
And that was from their stock.
There has been growth. The benefits from that growth have been very, very highly concentrated in a very, very small group of people. And so it helps, looking in one direction, that helps to explain why it is that although our economy has been growing, middle-income people really haven't felt that their living standard has been improving. And the explanation to that is that they're right. Their living standard hasn't been improving. The economy has been growing. The benefits from that growth have been accruing to a very small elite group of people. And then looking the other way, one might ask, well, you know, who is this 1%? And the answer is, well, it's people like CEOs.
Do you have a poster you used to publish on names and rates?
Pardon me?
Did the CCPA have posters that they used to make up yearly posting CEOs and their rates?
No. That was the Center for Social Justice. They did that in the 80s.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for your time today. I know I've taken quite a bit of it.
No problem.
I hope we've answered some questions, woken some people up. I know it's still going to be very confusing for a lot of people to know that here we have this growing debt and these CEOs are making all this money and I've lost my job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
What to do about it? Well, people say you have to go out and vote, and it's the right party to vote for, but since this has been going on for so long, every party's been involved.
Well, yeah, there's fingerprints all over this.
Where else could I look, Hugh? Where do you suggest I look?
Well, there is stuff being done on executive compensation in the United States at Economic Policy Institute.
Okay.
That's based in Washington. They do very good stuff.
Okay.
There aren't a whole lot of other sort of single sources. Andrew Jackson at CLC puts out regular stuff on the sort of the state of working Canada that's got useful information in it. There's lots of information out there.
Okay. Well, keep plugging away at the press and get this out as far as you can. Thanks for the work that you do. Thanks for making these reports public.
Okay.
And
great.
For listeners, this is a great amount of information you can get. I think when you sell your monitors for $35 a year still?
Yeah, I think so. Something like that.
Something like that. Okay. Well, thanks, Hugh.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want more information about the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, they publish a quarterly, which will, for $35, which supports their research, will keep you informed with some of Canada's leading policy analysts. They have many projects and many offices in Canada. Their initiatives are climate justice, economic security, education, the growing gap, Ontario alternative budget, senior care, social watch, trade and investment research project. You can find them on the web, policyalternatives.ca. And we'll take you to the CCPA website. We want to thank once again Hugh McKenzie for taking the time with us this morning to explain in a little more detail his paper about the best paid CEOs.
A cowboy town. Mm-hmm. horse I'll ride up on. At that golden chute will stand old St. Pete. He'll tip his hat and welcome me to Cowboy Town.
If you've been a long-time listener to this show, you know that I have been warning about the pipelines and the NAFTA highways that are going up and down North America. www.osi.ca, I'm sure you'll still find a link to NAFTA where you can go and see all the highways, starting in Laredo, Texas, up to Winnipeg. And in Canada, they go straight up to Churchill because, of course, the ice is melting in the Arctic and boats want to land. And Churchill's been getting a lot of money from Stephen Harper. And hardly anybody outside of Churchill knows about him. It's a good, interesting story there, too, about cronyism and the boys' club and putting your friends on the board. There is a policy research group out in the three prairie provinces. The Frontier Center for Policy Alternatives is a very interesting site to go and look at. It's the think tank that people in the prairie provinces use, and I'm sure Stephen Harper uses it. What's happened is the government has bought Via Rail, and then they sold it off as a private asset because apparently it was saving us money because it cost so much to maintain, and it was purchased by the same fellow that bought up the main newspaper chain in Indiana, and he shut that Daily Star newspaper down, but there was a very good investigative reporter at that paper who followed the link for the new owner of that Via Rail system. But there are pipelines, there is all kinds of names for them, the Alberta Clipper, and they're owned by Enbridge, they're owned by BP. They've been going down into Michigan, and I was very concerned because there is a refinery plant right on Lake Michigan. In fact, at one time I posted a picture showing the tailing ponds are within 500 meters or less of Lake Michigan. That's the tailing ponds. So if you've seen any commercials once in a while on TV saying that they can make tailing ponds dry up in 2 weeks, I don't think that's true. Do the research yourself. You'll see these tailing ponds are still very wet and very lethal for any wildlife. The reason I'm saying this is because a lot of these pipelines are cracking and leaking. And they're either leaking because they've been damaged in some way or because they can't take the cold. They go east and west across Canada, and they're not going into Quebec. They're not really coming into Ontario. They more or less stop at Winnipeg and head down into the States. Do your own research and find out about these pipelines because it's not in the big news. They're not talking about it. These are environmental hazards that are crawling all across North America. I'm going to play you a couple of cuts about a story that we did not get to hear about in this end of the country, the oil leak that goes into the Kalamazoo River that ends up in Lake Michigan.
Oil is spilling tonight into Michigan waterways. An estimated 20,000 barrels, what amounts to 840,000 gallons. It's floating in the water and now coating geese across the area. Crews are scrambling to stop the oil from spreading. 24-hour News 8's Tony Taliaferro has been on the story all day. He joins us live right now from Marshall. Tony?
Good evening, Susie. A spokeswoman for the owner of the pipeline says the company still isn't sure if there is oil coming out of that pipeline into the creek yet at this hour. The reason the company was able to shut off some valves, but if there's oil left in the segment of the pipeline that had that leak, it still could be coming into the water. This as we found a new impact while surveying the river tonight, oil-covered birds.
It just breaks your heart to see creatures suffering.
Neighbors alerted us to these geese on the Kalamazoo River shore between Marshall and Battle Creek.
It's just terrible. Somebody should be out here doing something.
We are aware of them. We're working with Fish and Wildlife now.
And that spokeswoman for the owner of the pipeline company says there will be a number of people can call to report animals in trouble. The spokeswoman says she's not sure how far the oil has traveled down the Kalamazoo River. We've been surveying it to try to find out. The oil has clearly made it as far as Suresco. That's on the way from Marshall to Battle Creek. The sheen can be seen coming down the dam here in town. And if you look closely at the plants that are in the middle of the river, you can see the oil stains. Crews are setting up barriers, but we wondered, are you confident that you'll be placing barriers at the point where the oil hasn't gotten to yet?
What I can say is that we're bringing our full resources to bear to contain and resolve this situation. Everything that we can throw at this, we are throwing at this.
The process of closing valves to try to stop the leak started around 9:45 a.m., according to the spokeswoman, when employees noticed a drop in pressure in the pipeline. We spoke with the Battle Creek man who says he was in the Marshall area and smelled the oil last night.
So I called 911, and that would have been about 9 o'clock.
Was Enbridge notified at that time?
Not to my knowledge. That process started at about 9:45 this morning when we noticed the drop in pressure.
Now, if you have an issue with an animal in danger or any spotting of oil, company officials say stay away from it. You can call this number. It's 800-306-6837 to report issues with the oil or, again, oil-covered animals. Now, the time it will take to clean up this spill, how much it will cost, and what caused the leak are all still unknowns at this point. But when we asked a company spokeswoman if Enbridge Energy will ultimately be responsible for paying for this cleanup, she pointed out it is, in fact, the company's pipeline. Live in Marshall, Tony Tagliavia, 24-Hour News 8. Good afternoon, Emily. That smell that was so very strong yesterday in Marshall, the smell of crude oil in the air is here. It's a lot less strong, but you can see there is still oil in the Kalamazoo River. We are at the Custer Drive Bridge over the river. It's at the very western edge of the city limits of Battle Creek. Now, with that smell being less strong, perhaps that's telling us the oil is less concentrated, but you can still see the effects. If you look at the vegetation, the plants along the banks of this river, you can see oil stains at the bottom of it. What we're trying to do here is pin down just how far downriver this oil has come. It started with a pipeline leak near 16 Mile Road and Division Drive south of Marshall. That oil leaked into the Talmadge Creek, and then right around 15 Mile Road and A Drive, again south of Marshall, is where Talmadge Creek empties into the Kalamazoo River. We spotted that oil yesterday coming through a barrier trying to stop it there. Last night, we saw the oil moving past Suresco, and here we are now past downtown Battle Creek, downriver of downtown Battle Creek, at the Custer Drive Bridge at the very western edge of the city limits of Battle Creek. Now, at last check, the emergency management folks in Kalamazoo County had not yet had any reports of oil there. But throughout the day, we're going to continue moving west to see how far this oil indeed moves before it can be stopped. Live in Battle Creek, Tony Tagliavia, 24-Hour News 8.
Here we are at 9.5 Mile Road. Still large amounts of clumps of oil.
Calling this an environmental nightmare tonight that's taking a toll on people as well.
These pipelines are a mile down the road from me. They're north, they're south of me, a mile. Never thought in 100 years we'd have this. Never thought it.
2 days after John LaForge was forced from his home by the stench and the filth of the thick black oil that has invaded his property, and 3 days after a 30-inch pipe ruptured, sending a million gallons of oil into the creek and then the Kalamazoo River, killing fish, coating wildlife, and contaminating the water, LaForge is ready to burst himself, not knowing when or if he and his wife and daughter and grandchildren will be back in their home in Marshall Township.
They told me we'd be probably put up for 30 days in the motel because these trucks are going to be out here running for the next 25, 30 days, cleaning up all this oil that keeps leaching off the banks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my feeling is I don't think it's safe. I can't jeopardize my health, let alone my family's health. So what do? You move.
Tonight, crews are skimming and pumping the oil out of the creek on his land. But there is word that oil has been spotted in Morrow Lake, 35 miles away. Everyone had hoped that would not happen. And despite a promise from Enbridge CEO Pat Daniel that they have doubled their cleanup efforts and will pay for everything and compensate the families affected, the governor said the Enbridge response is wholly inadequate.
So this is a serious situation. We want to send out the alarm that we need additional resources.
The Enbridge CEO is saying tonight it should be days and not weeks or months before the pipeline is fixed. The question is, how long will it be before life along the banks of the Kalamazoo River gets back to normal? In Battle Creek, I'm Cheryl Choden, Channel 7 Action News.
All right, thank you, Cheryl.
Holy mackerel. It was just thick crude oil.
It looked like somebody had emptied about 10,000 gallons of black, dirty motor oil out of their car and just got a very pungent smell to it. Right now, the water's flowing to the south into the river there, and they're back there trying to put planks, install these planks to keep this water flow from, you know, making its way to the creek over here.
It's very important that if they see oil, that they stay away from it. We don't want them getting into the oil. We don't want them touching oil. We don't want them getting close enough where they can breathe.
This river flows all the way to Lake Michigan, so there's a lot of people downstream that should be concerned.
Huge setbacks. I mean, years and years are gone. And I sit there and I feel bad. I feel like I'm empathizing with the people down the Gulf Coast right now. It's too soon to panic at the moment. So we'll just wait, and I'm sure that people will let us know what to expect.
A crude oil spill continues to move closer to Lake Michigan tonight. New at 10, 12 News, Terry Sater has been looking into the threat it poses to Milwaukee shoreline.
Now, the EPA estimates the spill at more than a million gallons. Dozens of families have been asked to evacuate, and it serves as a reminder oil spills are not just a Gulf Coast phenomenon.
This isn't the Gulf Coast. These clumps of crude oil in the water are the result of a pipeline breaking in a Michigan river. It's a river that feeds into Lake Michigan, and people there are concerned.
The Gulf oil spill has been in the news, and we've seen that, and you always think, well, that's something that's going to happen to somebody else.
As the crude oil spreads downstream, it could damage Lake Michigan fish and tourism.
It's very sad. It's such a precious resource.
Enbridge is the company that operates the broken pipeline in Michigan and also operates pipelines in Wisconsin. Enbridge is promising it will be totally accountable and has crews scrambling to stop the damage before it reaches Lake Michigan.
Our intent is to return your community to its original state and the waterways to their normal state, and we do commit to doing that.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time.
They're not being reported in the news, of course. So what I predicted and what the First Nations people have been saying all along, transporting this crude, thick, sluggish, dirty oil all across Canada to dig it down into the States in pipelines won't work.
You can run on for a long time.
Still think that the oil corporations know what they're doing? Can you trust them? Remember the Exxon Valdez? And that was also Enbridge.